Welcome back to After the Buzzer. I am Gordy Jones, and joining me as always, maybe one of the last times we'll be doing this remotely, is Mike Gross. Hello, Mike.
You're right. I think we can get together maybe next week.
This is a good thing. This is a very good
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
For one thing, my dog misses you.
Yeah, I had a pinch. I felt there was a connection there, which is strange. Yeah, but there you go.
And Our guest this week is Rob Berger, who our listeners may recall as the ace pitcher on Lampeter Strasburg's 1994 state championship team. And he also pitched for 7 years in the minor leagues, the bulk of that in the Phillies organization, rising to Double-A Reading. And he is now a Pequot Township police officer and has been since 2003. So welcome to you, Rob.
Well, thank you, Mike. Thank you, Gordy. I appreciate you guys having me on this evening.
So I guess when I spoke to you a couple of years ago for a story, you mentioned just about, you know, when you're in the minor leagues, just kind of seizing the moment. What do you recall about coming up through the chain and what that was like and what your thoughts were and just, you know, really what a blur it was? What comes back to you now when you think about that time in your life?
Yeah, boy, I think back and think that was, you know, 25, 27-ish.
Yeah.
Ish years ago, it kind of seems like a little bit of a blur, but certainly it's something that I wanted to do ever since I was a little kid, you know, playing for Willow Street and you know, playing in the new eras and coming up through LS High School and whatnot, and then finally getting the opportunity to play professionally with the Philadelphia Phillies of all teams. And you know, it was a great experience. Certainly, it's not, the minor leagues is not the glamour show that everyone thinks that it really is. And you know, being in the major leagues, which unfortunately I never had the opportunity to do, but, you know, long bus rides, you know, a lot of, Waffle Houses, a lot of, Domino's pizzas in the rooms. So it can be a grind, you know, being on the road a lot, but, you know, you got to start somewhere, and, that's where the guys start. To get where they ultimately want to be.
Rob, I'm covering high school baseball as kind of as a beat this year for the first time, even though I've been a sports writer for 400 years. And watching the game, it's been interesting and kind of instructive to me to watch the game as it's played in at the high school level. And there's a lot of, in our league, there's a lot of pitchers that are Division One, that are going to be Division One pitchers, that have gotten recruited, that may even get drafted, but none of them are anywhere near as consistently effective as you were. And I'm not saying this to blow smoke, but I don't ever remember a high school pitcher being as consistently dominant as you were. Looking back on it now, the consistency. How do you think you were able to do that?
Well, I appreciate that. You know, I'm not sure. I, you know, kind of put myself and my team of the teams that I came up with at LS in my head versus some of the teams that we had the opportunity to play this year. And, you know, there's some really good talent in the Lancaster Lebanon League and all over the state of ball player. As far as the consistency, I don't know. You know, you work hard in the off season. You know, you go out and do your job on the mound and try to throw strikes. And, you know, hopefully good things happen. I was fortunate enough to stay healthy. And I was fortunate enough to be blessed with, you know, an arm, you know, that was able to, you know, throw pretty hard. And we had great players, you know, with me when I was playing. But I look at some of the teams this year and look at Manheim Township. I look at some of the boys from, you know, Warwick. They got some arms. I look at Colton Look, you know. Some of the arms that are in the league this year are phenomenal. And B. Carp at LS, you know, he didn't even have the opportunity to throw. So I would have loved to have seen him throw. But, yeah, there's a lot of talent throughout the league this year. And, you know, it's going to be fun to see how this thing wraps up.
Yeah, there could be a lot of baseball still to go. A little bit about being a dad of a baseball player. How different do you see the game now as a parent? out there for? Do you feel the game? How emotional is it for you? What's that experience like?
It's surreal. You know, I kind of got the start with my oldest daughter coming up through playing softball. She played travel softball and then played for Solanco, and they had some really good teams, and she did some pitching. I had, you know, my second daughter, she played for some pretty good basketball teams down at Solanco. So, and now with Tyler, you know, coming up through and playing some baseball, it's a different experience altogether. I'm sure any dad that has a player that's on the, you know, the field or the court will tell you, I get more wound up inside, you know, preparing to watch them play. I guess it's the no control thing. You know, when I was on the court or when I was on the field, I had control. You know, I was throwing the ball, I was shooting the ball, I was getting the rebounds and whatnot. But you try to teach, the kids the way it should be, try to give them some answers to the test. But then ultimately they're the ones that are out on the field or on the court. And, you know, it's a great experience. I love it. I love watching them more than I even did playing. And I'm sure any dad will tell you that have the experience that I had.
Well, what kind of advice do you try to give Tyler about pitching or just competing in general?
I'll try to trust his stuff. You know, he's a left-handed pitcher. You know, he still has a lot to learn, as well as, you know, all these kids do. You know, sometimes, you know, we have our little head-butting sessions. that's the fun part. You know, we kind of have a routine for after the games where we don't talk. We kind of just let the game kind of go away, whether it was a good game or whether it was a bad game, and kind of let it go. And until he's ready to talk about it. And then was kind of an unwritten rule that we got that once he's ready to talk about it, and I'll realize, okay, we're good to open that door and talk about some things that he worked on or some things that he did well. And that way I'm not pressing. I don't want to press. This is his adventure. Coach Fish down at Solanco, you know, he always stresses to the boys, this is their adventure, you know. This is their adventure, and then they need to take care of, you know, guiding their own adventure. And the same thing with him. It's his adventure. So when he's ready to talk and ready to learn, you know, I'm all ears and ready to help.
Yeah, and speaking of adventures, that 1994 season, I went back and looked. You guys started 6-8 and then won your last 14, including the state final where – You and Joel Beiler switched back between pitching and first base, and Joel pitched a three-hit shutout against West Allegheny in the championship game, and you scored the game's only run in the first inning. that's a long time ago, as we just discussed, but what do you recall about that? Anything stick with you all these years later?
You know what? I just got a chill thinking about it. And one of our family friends, she actually gave me some pitchers, last week, I think it was, and one of them was a pitcher when I scored the winning run and was coming off the field. And that was only in the first inning, I believe, to put us up 1-0. And ultimately Joel held him down for, you know, the next seven innings, and we ended up winning 1-0. Great experience. You know, I just remember, you know, the bus ride up, and it was probably 100 degrees that day. Mm-hmm. And it was unbelievable. Joel pitched a great game.
He did.
But yeah, we started out 6-8 and, we thought we had a team, you know, that was going to put something together, but we just didn't get out of the chute real well and started 6-8. And they kept us together and we stuck to the plan and ultimately started stringing some wins together. We I think we won a game at Garden Spot. And it's funny how I can remember these things right now. We won a game at Garden Spot, and that kind of got us on a roll. And, you know, we were getting the pitching, and we were getting the timely hits, and ultimately put it together. And the funny thing is, we ended up winning the league, districts, and states, and we didn't even win our section that year. So that tells you where we were at, right?
That's weird. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
That says something about the league, maybe a little bit.
But yeah, well, there was good teams back then, too. You know, I mean, there's always good baseball. Lancaster County, there's some good baseball going on.
Well, let's go into a little bit into your pro career, because I remember you being grouped together with three other pitchers as like a group of guys that the Phillies were really high on, and they kind of grouped you guys together for some reason. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, Dave Coggan, Jason Kirshner, and Randy Knoll were the other three.
What was that about, and why was that such a thing? Because that got a fair amount of media attention.
I remember that. Certainly, I was drafted in '94, and Kirshner '95, Noel '95, and Davey Coggin was '95 as well. And we came up together, and they called us Marcus Hayes from, I think he was with the Inquirer, Philadelphia Inquirer at the time.
Right.
I think he had called us the Four Horsemen or something.
Four Amigos, the Four Amigos.
That was it. And he did a real nice article on us, and it kind of went off from there. You know, Dave and I had the arms. You know, we threw pretty hard. Dave was a supplemental first rounder in 95. He actually had a ride to go to Clemson to play quarterback. So he ended up signing with the Phillies in the first round supplemental. And Jason was a top 10 pick, and Randy Noel was a top 10 pick as well in 95. And Dave and Randy were from California. Jason was from Arizona. And, we had a lot of success coming up through. And I think, the ultimate outlook was to have us get up to Philadelphia together. But we had some injuries. And, Dave made it in probably after 2000, around in there. And I think Jason had some cups of coffee. He was a lefty, quirky lefty, as they all are. He played for the Blue Jays or some other teams like that. So he got his taste as well. So yeah, they were good. They're good guys. You know, great memories.
I mean, it is a real commentary about just how tight the strainer gets as you move up the ladder, and B, just the physical toll that it takes. Because as you mentioned, Coggin and Noel had shoulder issues. Jason had an elbow issue. And you told me a couple years ago that you had a back problem when you started out real well in 98, and you kind of pushed through it. And if you have any second guesses about your career, maybe you could have shut it down then, right? It does take a toll, obviously.
It does, you know, as well as the physical toll that it takes every day, you know, being on point and, trying to keep your body at optimum readiness for that next game or whatnot, you know, the mental part as well. I mean, it's a mental absolute grind, just being ready every day and, having to get your body ready. And that's part of the mental point too. And as we know, baseball's a game of failure.
Yeah.
And, if you're not on point mentally as well as physically, it's gonna eat you up.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think maybe I should have taken a step back and going on the DL for a little bit. But I was throwing well. In 98, I was throwing well. I think I was 3-0 at one point, was like a through 40 some innings and had like a 1.4 ERA. And I was feeling it. You know, I was ready to go. I was on the 40 man that year, and I pulled a lat muscle in my back, and I probably should have just sat back for a little bit, but I tried to push through thinking I got this. And I'm not ultimately saying that was what the ultimate deal breaker was for my career, but you look back on little things and say, hey, what about this or what if that, but it is what it is at this point.
Mm-hmm.
What did you Rob, what was your chronology? Now I remember when you were in Reading, and so how many years did you spend in A and then double A, and then take us through the chronology of how you moved through the minor league system.
Sure. I got drafted in 94, the summer of 94. I was a 10th round draft pick out of LS. Had a little bit of a negotiation with the Phillies, ultimately ended up signing with them. I went to Martinsville, Virginia, which is in the Appalachian League. So certainly, if you've ever been to Martinsville, Virginia, basically they're known for the big race down there. Other than that, there ain't much in Martinsville, Virginia. It's a little old town. I stayed with a host family down there. So I was down in Martinsville in 94. In 95, I went back there in 1995, which was a short season A ball league. In 1996, I went up to Piedmont, which was Kannapolis, North Carolina, and played for the Piedmont Boll Weevils. And they had a 2-year-old stadium Fieldcrest Cannon Stadium. It's funny how I remember these things right now. Fieldcrest Cannon Stadium, which was like a two-year-old stadium, beautiful stadium. We had a great team there. I even the year before, played with Ricky Williams, who was Heisman winner, you know. Mm-hmm. So I played with him. He got drafted by the Phillies in 95 out of California. So I played with he was on my team in 95, 96, 97. I was at Clearwater, Florida State League. I think I led the league in strikeouts.
Yes,
that
you
year.
Did. You did.
I had a pretty nice year that year. And then I got after that year, I got promoted to, in the offseason, promoted to the 40-man roster. So in the spring of 1998, I went down to big league camp and was down with Lenny Dykstra and the whole gang down there, and got to show was down there as well. Terry Francona, my daughter, right in smack dab of my big league camp, my first big league camp, my daughter Callan was born. So I remember Terry Francona coming up to me and saying, it kind of scared me, came right up to me. He said, Rob Berger, he goes, I heard you had a baby. And I said, yeah, Skip, I did. He goes, you want to go home? And I said, Skip, man, I'm down here. This is my first my first camp. I want to make an impression. He goes, listen, we're family down here. He goes, you go home for 2 days, see your baby, and then come back here. Not a problem. So he was wonderful to allow me. So I went down, up, came home, went back, spent 1998 with the Reddings, and went down and played in the Maryland Fall League in the fall of 98, 99. I went to Reading, and kind of the wheels fell off in 99, unfortunately. And so then they sent me back down, and I played some extended ball, some AA ball back with Clearwater. And then in the 1999, I went to end of 99, I got Rule 5 by the Colorado Rockies, and I played with the Salem Avalanche and the Asheville Tourists for a couple months. Things weren't going real great. My wife was pregnant with our second daughter at the time, and at that point, I kind of just made the executive decision along with her that maybe it's time to shut it down, and we're going to come home and start working find another employment.
Mm-hmm. That was pretty impressive the way you reeled that off.
I don't know how I did it. You know, you have me back memory lane, I'm telling you.
One of the things that I remember, and I'm almost a little sheepish about bringing this up, but it was such a vivid day for me. It was when you were it was the second game of the season in Reading, and you got the start. And you really struggled.
Yeah.
I was covering the game. I went in at the clubhouse after the game, and I was sort of proud of you and impressed with you that you were willing to talk about it and willing to stand up to it. And then I went in and talked to Gary Varsho, the manager, and he kind of ripped you a little bit, which stunned me and stunned my buddy Mike Drago for the Reading paper, who covered that team all the time.
Yeah.
And I heard later that Varsho kind of got called on the carpet by Ed Wade for doing that. But I know that's not a pleasant day, but what are your memories of that day?
No, you know, I remember, and I could be off. I'm thinking, was that game against Erie? I don't know why Erie's...
That sounds right. I'm not sure, but that sounds right.
Yeah, it was an early game, and... certainly you come out of spring training, and they wouldn't have had me pitch the second or third game, whatever it was, if I wasn't throwing well. I'd be one of their starters again. You know, they pretty much have their starters or the guys that they're looking forward to push up through to the next level. And certainly at the double-A level, you're only an injury away. You know, they call guys up from double-A, you know, all the time. So they had me there. So, you know, I probably deserve to get ripped, you know. It certainly wasn't the outcome or the outing that I would have wanted to have, and it's not on purpose, but you know, these things unfortunately happen, you know, to guys. You know, but the thing is, Varsho, you know, Gary, his job's on the line. You know, they need to produce, and what I've realized is, you know, unless you're one of the top guys, and I was one of their prospects for a while, but once I started going down the sliding board the other way, it really got to be, what have you done for me lately?
Mm.
Yeah. And it's a sport where you're going to have your grace period if they have money in you or if you prove that you can do it. And I had a grace period for a while that they really were trying to work with me and help me through, you know, my command issues and whatnot. But once it went the other way, you know, it kind of was like, well, you know, we've given you your opportunity. You know, what have you done for me lately? And it wasn't a whole lot. I wasn't producing for them. So, you know, it ultimately, you know, they decided to make a decision to send me down.
How hard is that to process when you're a young man?
You know, it ate me up for a while, because about the time as I was 24 years old, mm-hmm. you kind of start to realize your mortality in the sport, mm-hmm. and realize that it's not going to be forever.
Yeah.
And after a while, you see guys and buddies of yours that are are getting released and are starting with other teams or other organizations, and you don't want it. You know, certainly you want to hang on as long as possible, and you see this handwriting on the wall at times, mm-hmm. And that's what was happening.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could just verbalize what it's like as you move up through the chain and you see, you know, the upgrade in talent. I mean, it's that's got to be kind of sobering to see it from one level to the next. How does that reflect itself with the hitters? I'm guessing they're a lot more selective and a lot more savvy as far as what they're able to handle and what they're able to do with it. But what is it like beyond that?
Well, I think what people forget is when you have a lot of success at the high school level or the college level, mm-hmm. that's in your little area, whatever. Mm-hmm. But then once you get to the professional level, these are the best guys in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're playing against them, you got to have your A stuff all the time. I remember the first time that I actually got in the mound down in Martinsville,
mm-hmm.
and I was throwing, you know, 90, 94, whatever I was throwing. And one of the first pitches I had, the guy hit a line drive to left field. And I thought, you know, here we go, you know, it's what am I getting myself into? I mean, there's guys up there, they're professional hitters. They always say that they can hit a bullet if they have enough time to time it.
Uh-huh.
And certainly they did. I was able to develop a curveball, and at the time my command was relatively decent. I was a strikeout pitcher, but my command was decent. Still walked some guys. You know, I wish I would have had a changeup.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I preach to these boys nowadays that it's fastball changeup. You know, even at the high school level, if you're commanding your fastball and you can throw an all-speed pitch, mm-hmm. you're going to have a lot of success. And I really feel the same way at the professional level. If I would have been taught a changeup when I was in high school or when I first got in, I think it would have certainly helped.
Hmm.
That's interesting. I was at the Manheim Central game last night, and Colton Book pitched, and you know, and he was real the first time through the lineup. He was really, really impressive, and he threw a couple. He got a couple of swings and misses, and one strikeout. And remember, in particular, that I remember, and I thought that's obviously not a fastball. It's something off speed, and it's not a breaking ball either. He must. I never saw him throw a changeup before, but he must have a pretty good changeup. And I talked to him after the game, and he said, "Yeah, that's what it was. I have a changeup, and I threw a couple of really good ones in those situations."
The thing is, even if you can show it, you know, sometimes you don't even have to throw it for a strike, but if you can just show it, mm-hmm. so in the back of the batter's mind, he's thinking he got another pitch in there, and it might be 8 to 10 mile an hour different, and it'll make me look dumb. That's all you need sometimes, and then guess what? You can get that fastball and throw it by him, even if it's not an overpowering fastball. So I would have liked to have gone up and seen Colton last night. I'm not sure if you know Jeff Book, who went to LS. Yeah. That's his boy, and Jeff was a LS graduate in 92. He was a hell of a baseball player at LS as well.
Oh, okay. I did not know that.
Rob, I ask this of our guests often, and when you compete at such a high level and it ends, how do you replace the rush? Because that's got to be an incredible rush to compete at that sort of level.
There's a void. There's a void. Certainly when I got out of playing ball for a while, I didn't want to watch baseball.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to go to many games, you know, just kind of had to get away for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what it was, but you know, you still have that competition factor So I, after I got out, I didn't want to watch it. Now I played for Schmitty's Cardinals for Schmitty for a year or two, and went up when he needed a pitcher, and threw some innings for him. But played basketball, you know. Basketball is a sport I love as well. So I played a lot of basketball for that competitive, you know, get that the competitive juices going, and that's something that I really enjoyed. Doing as well, which took some of that spare time and got to use it in that way.
Well, what do you watch? What do you notice when you watch a game now on TV? What do you look at?
Well, you know, I look at some of the guys that are throwing 100. I mean, every guy that comes in throws 100, which is crazy to me. I don't know if something's juiced somewhere along the line or what. You know, every guy that comes in is blowing 100 mile an hour, and you think, this is nuts. But these guys are working year-round, and they're bigger, stronger, faster. You know, there's the technology in baseball is just crazy now. You know, I was working with Coach Shell up at the Nook, and he's I think it's the associate head coach for Lebanon Valley, and he's working with me with Repsodo pitch development, and you know, looking at spin rate, looking at spin efficiency on different pitches, and you know, how you want to map the pitches and how the pitches are matrixed in and whatnot, and the profiles of them. And I look at when I'm trying to learn, I'm just scratching the surface at this point, but then I'm putting it into the when I watch it. So I'm not just watching the game, I'm looking at the spin, I'm looking at, you know, what the guys are doing off the spin, seeing, you know, of course, maybe a little bit more in depth what the spin's doing for the pitches and whatnot. It takes it to a whole nother level, you know. It's like starting over again.
Yeah, I guess it is kind of a different game now than it was when it is, in some respects, I guess.
It is. Absolutely. It's fun to watch. But, you know, still rooting for the Phils, you know. I'm waiting for that breakout year.
Yeah.
Right.
We were just talking that we had this thing with the Barnstormers the other day. This guy from Major League Baseball was there. And they're trying to find a way to improve the tempo of the game, get more balls put in play, make it a more entertaining game. That whole idea of the three true outcomes and kind of getting away from that. What do you think about that? When you watch the game, are you thinking the pace? I'd like to see more balls put in play. What's your sort of take on the sort of sabermetric revolution here?
Well, at this point, in my mind, the pitchers are so far ahead of the hitters. You know, I mean, you look at the major league average of hitters this year. What was it? 230s, 200, whatever it was. It was crazy. I mean, it was crazy. But the pitchers are throwing so hard now, and you know, they got so much more analytics, and you got the hitters worried about launch angles. Yeah. So they're not worried about the small ball, putting the ball in play, moving the runners. They want to hit a three run. They want someone to go 1-for-4 with a 3-run home run, and don't care if he strikes out, you know, the other three times.
Yeah.
So that develops kind of a boring game, if you ask me. You know, it's fun to hit behind a guy, move the guy, you know, a sack fly, put the ball in play, keep the pace of play going. But I got the ultimate one. If the umpires would call strikes a true strike, it would absolutely speed up the game of play. And they're worried about moving the mound back. They're worried about, you know, moving the bases back, this, that, and whatever else, a pitch clock. And my simple theory is if the umpires would call true strikes, it would make the batter swing the bat. And guess what? There's your problem resolved.
Yeah.
Is it the high pitch? Is that the one?
I would think so, yeah, because...
Yeah, I think so, too, yeah.
It's, I mean, when... Well, we're always... Well, let me put it this way. When I was younger and coming up through, they always wanted us to throw down in the zone for ground balls. Now they're starting to realize with some of this analytical spin rate stuff that guys with high spin on their fastball are better off throwing up in the zone because that ball is going to shoot up and rise a little bit. So it's that high fastball that we were always taught... to stay away from. But if a guy can get his fastball by a guy, you know, at above the belt or right around the belt or whatnot, and he can get away with it, call it a strike, because if that guy gets it and lifts it, it might be gone. So it's that high strike that if somebody that the umpires need to call, in my opinion, and they're not really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. And the reason why I asked that is because, again, going back to this thing with the Barnstormers, which, as you probably know, they have this experimental agreement with MLB to do experimental rules changes, and they're doing that robo umpires thing, but they're going to adjust the strike zone this year to make it slightly smaller from top to bottom than the literal rule book strike zone, which to me is almost, I wonder if that isn't the opposite of what you want to do.
Well, it doesn't. Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not Rob Manfred, but it goes against everything that I would have thought. You know, I mean, the reason to have that computer system there is to call the true strike. Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, these umpires, you know, even when I was coming up through, you know, when I got to the AA level, it seemed like that strike zone went from a strike zone regular to a shoebox.
Huh.
And I remember being on the mound thinking, how am I going to throw a strike here? Because they're really shoeboxing the guy in. And then between starts, you'd go back and sit in the stands and watch guys throwing and pitches that you think are strikes all day. They're calling balls. Mm-hmm. So it almost gets in your head where you're thinking, man, I got to be perfect. I got to be perfect to throw a strike here. And then it starts messing with you a little bit. And then you start pressing. And then guess what? You start throwing balls. You know, baseball is not a sports press. You know, you want to be relaxed and just go play. But yeah, that's certainly with the Barnstormers, it doesn't sit well with me, but ultimately I'm sure they have a reason for it. I don't know why.
It'll be interesting to watch that this year, because that's what I think too. I think that high strike is a key component in maybe changing this, but I mean
it's called strikes. But then the hitter knows, guess what? I got to swing at the bat. I got to swing at the ball.
Yeah.
And, it improves the pace of play. You know, you got pitchers throwing more strikes, batters swinging at more pitches. I mean, it has no other way to go but to speed it up.
So, Rob, what led you to gravitate to police work after you were done playing?
That's a good question. I know that after I got out and, you know, we went through 9/11 mm-hmm. in September of 2001, big push, seeing everything on TV and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of hit me that, you know, there needs to be service workers out there for mm-hmm. the community.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys are putting their lives on the line. And I saw what happened up in New York. And my uncle just made a comment to me right around the same time. He said, you know what, I always thought you'd be a good cop. And I don't know why that hits with me. And it sat with me. And about that time, I thought, you know what? Let's see what I can do here. So yeah, I put myself through the academy at HAC, Harrisburg Community College, and I got hired by Southern Regional Police Department, John Fiorell, who was I think he was a lieutenant at the city. He came down and he was the chief at Peckway Township, and then he was the chief when it merged over to Southern Regional. So John Fiorell,
mm-hmm.
He gave me the opportunity, and you know, we've been running ever since.
Mm-hmm. And we should point out to our listeners that you were honored as the Officer of the Year at Southern Regional in 05, 06, and 2012. And your title now is Sergeant Detective, correct? I have that title card?
My title is Sergeant Detective at this point. Mm-hmm. So I did our investigations and do patrol supervisory work, administrative work. So pretty much throw a bunch of different hats on my head and I'll take care of it, I guess.
All right. There's one thing I need to square away, Rob, and this was a tiny little thing, and I don't know why I remember this. This is how my mind works. You were playing Effort in a game at Effort. I think it was a playoff game or something. It was a night game, and the Effort coach made the cardinal sin of wandering behind your catcher while you were warming up between innings. And you dusted him. Was that on purpose?
Well, you know what? I remember that. It may or may not have. You know, I don't know. Sometimes putting a little fear into somebody, whether it's a coach or not, gets the batter thinking a little bit, and certainly doesn't let him dig in as much as what he might want to. So, no, I do remember that, though.
I can still picture it. he went down.
Yeah, yeah. Boy, they were fun games up at Ephrata. You know, we had the opportunity to play up at Ephrata this year at a night game, and man, what a special place to play.
It really is. It really is, and it is always the site of the big games. That's for sure. If you're playing there, you know you've had a good year, or in the midst of a good year. That's for sure. So
you're right. You're right. Absolutely.
So Rob, one of the great pleasures of Mike's job and mine is just to revisit people that we covered back through the year. So this has been really nice to speak with you, and we really appreciate the time and your insights, and we wish you all the best.
Well, guys, I appreciate you having me on, and certainly maybe in another 10 or 15, 20 years, if you want to give me a shout, I'm more than happy to come on and talk to you guys. I enjoy it.
Who knows what the technology will be by then, Rob?
You're right. Absolutely.
We're hologramming each other.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But thanks so much. Rob. Be well, Rob. Take care.
You bet. Thanks, guys. Be safe.
So, Mike, as I mentioned, that is always nice to be able to visit once again with people we covered way back when. And certainly, you know, Rob has a real clear vision of how things unfolded and great perspective on his career. And just, as he mentioned, just how baseball is a game of failure. And you know, things go sideways. It happens a lot. And he's obviously come to grips with that. So I thought it was a nice conversation with Rob. It was really great to visit with him.
Yeah, it's great that he has been able to come out the other side of it.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It seems like he's having a good life as a father and as a policeman and all that. It's great. And it's amazing how wrong you remember things.
Yes.
If Vlad Peter Strasburg was 6-8,
and
I'm remembering it wrong.
Yeah.
Because if they had 8 losses, then he must have had some of them.
Yeah.
And I never remember him getting hit around at all.
No. And the other pitcher was really good, too. The other pitcher was very good.
Yeah, they're two really ace-type guys. Absolutely.
Yeah, so it was great to visit with him, and you know, certainly, as you mentioned, he is having a great life. So he and his wife Misty, who was actually his high school sweetheart, they have 4 children in all. So good for them, and we certainly wish Rob the best.
Yeah, that was good. It was good to catch up with him. Yeah, interesting. I couldn't agree more about that high strike. I was I was really surprised to hear this guy from MLB. It was Gil Martinez.
Okay.
Who's a former major league pitcher who is now the MLB's like senior director for on field strategy or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So he's trying to figure out how to tweak the game. And that's the one thing that I was really surprised that I took from the Barnstormers media day thing that they had on Monday. But anyway, we'll see how that works.
Yeah, so we'll move on to other topics. As we record here, it's Wednesday, about 20 minutes away from the Sixers playing game 2 against the Wizards. And I don't anticipate that being much of a series. The Sixers kind of won routinely, not super impressively, but impressively enough in game 1. And as you might expect, Joel Embiid is going to be a big problem for a lot of teams, but especially the Wizards.
And he didn't really go crazy in that game.
No.
But they got a huge game from Tobias Harris, who has really had a good year, and 37 points in game 1.
And that ain't bad.
He's a problem. He's going to be a matchup problem for a lot of teams.
Yeah, and there are curiosities throughout the playoffs. So one of them being the two L.A. teams. As we sit here, the Lakers won game 2 against Phoenix last night, and it looks like Phoenix might be in some trouble because Chris Paul has a shoulder injury, and that is a big, big problem for them.
How many times has this happened to Chris Paul?
I was thinking that too today. I was remembering a couple years ago when he was with Houston and they had a 3-1 lead over the Warriors, and he pulled a hammy and the Warriors came all the way back and beat him. Yeah, well, you know, he's an older guy. Now, granted, he does take care of himself. He's one of those guys who doesn't eat sugar, and God bless him for that, because that's something that I could never do. So he's in great shape, but, you know, it's a tough game.
It is a tough game, and it seems like this has happened probably more than it actually has, but it's really tough because he's so good.
Yeah.
He's so good, and they can't win the series without him. I'm not sure they can win it with him.
Yeah.
But a couple of things about these LA teams.
Yes.
The Clippers and the Lakers.
Yes.
You know, there's so much of this And in the Lakers' case, it was enforced on them. They didn't choose to do it. But this load management stuff, we all want so badly to believe in the importance of chemistry in basketball and guys playing together and spending and developing that cohesiveness.
Yes.
And the Clippers have just kind of shrugged and thumbed their nose at that a little bit the last couple of years. And I would like to think that this is their comeuppance for that a little bit.
Maybe so.
They're a mess, and they're not very good defensively.
Which is stunning.
When you think about the individuals involved there.
Yeah.
They ought to be.
Yeah, they ought to be great. I mean, yeah, they've gotten skewered. They're down 0-2 to the Mavericks, and let's not forget that they kind of tanked their way into facing the Mavericks. That's the team they wanted, and it falls under the category of be careful what you wish for. So now they're down 0-2 going to Dallas, and I was thinking about this today. Luka has obviously vaulted himself to, you know, maybe a new level now that we should regard him in a different way as one of the top, I don't know, half dozen or however you want to look at it, players in the league.
I would put him in the top half dozen.
Yeah. Here's the other little sidelight to that. On draft day in 2018, the Hawks drafted Luka number 3, then Dallas drafted Trae Young number 5, and then they swapped, and that looks like one of those rare trades that's going to work out pretty well for both teams, because Trae Young was just dynamic in game 1 against the Knicks. Just tremendous.
Yeah, that was his first playoff game of his career, and he was really good, and he was really good in the clutch, and I was amazed at how vociferous he was in reacting to the crowd at the end of that game.
he said a couple naughty words.
I almost get the feeling that these guys are not used to having people scream at them after the pandemic. You know what I mean? I've seen some reactions to crowds that are just like, dude, it's fans yelling at you. Who cares? But anyway, he was very good. I'm not a huge fan of the way he plays. I think there's a lot of kind of working the refs in his game a little bit.
Yeah, probably so.
But he impressed me the other night. I thought that was a tough spot on the road against a decent team that was playing decent, certainly in stretches of that game. And he kind of got his team over the top. So he impressed me. Sure.
Yeah, there were a lot of things about that game that jumped out at me, because I've not watched the Hawks this year at all. They have a lot of guys who can hurt you, shooting the ball particularly. Bogdanovich and Gallinari and Kevin Huerter. Yeah. Even DeAndre Hunter made a big three down the stretch of the game. And, you know, Capella's a very serviceable player. They have a lot of guys who can do some things. I mean, you know.
Yeah, they have built around a little guy in a way that I wonder if that wouldn't have happened before. I wonder if that would have happened before guys like Steph Curry and maybe Damian Lillard came along.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know what I mean? You build around the little guy. I don't know, but it seems like it's working to an extent. Yeah. I mean, certainly they're not a threat to.
No, they're not going to.
I don't think, but it's working to an extent. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're an interesting team. I mean, they'll make you guard them, that's for sure.
And the thing is that I'm not sure what his stats are, but when I've watched Trae Young, for a guy who is so ball dominant, he does not kick the ball around a lot.
No, he's.
I don't know how his turnover stats are, but it doesn't look to me like he makes a lot of mistakes, which is impressive when you have all the, you know, like that option quarterback thing almost.
That's so much fair.
On your plate. Yeah,
so I certainly an impressive, and I got to admit, it was kind of cool to see a playoff game back in the Garden, because that is a really magical place. I mean, I'm not going to say I was, you know, rooting for the Knicks by any stretch of the imagination, but it was kind of cool to see that.
And, you know, that reminds me of something. Really, in the last couple of weeks, watching sports, it has started to feel like the pandemic is really over.
Mm-hmm.
The long siege is really coming to an end.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of a couple examples, one of which was that Manheim Township, Manheim Central baseball game the other night at Ephrata. I think there were as many people at that game as I've ever seen at a high school baseball game. And like, Manheim Central had a student rooting section that was going nuts, and that was striking. that crowd at the PGA on Sunday, I know you're not a golf guy, Gordy, but when Phil Mickelson won the PGA and there were just this mob scene around the 18th green, and then some of these NBA playoff games, and I think in particular that one at the Garden, started to feel like, okay, we're back.
Yeah, I'm happy about that. I can live with that. This is an off the beaten path aside. The other day, I had the good fortune to speak with Pat Croce, who is launching an initiative designed where he gives what he calls an hour of power every Wednesday to cancer survivors and patients and caregivers and loved ones. And, you know, basically he gives them a pep talk because Pat has turned. He's always been a physical fitness guy and still is very much so, but now he's very much a mindfulness guy. So I spoke with him the other day, and he was just talking about how he reached a point in his life when he turned 60 and he just kind of rearranged his priorities a little bit. Like, you know, do I really need another bar restaurant in Key West? He owns, I think, a half dozen of them. do I need this? Do I need that? And it's like, so
I was just thinking that the other day myself.
Yeah, same.
Do I need another bar restaurant in Key West?
Yes. I'd like to have one.
Yeah.
I'd settle for that. But at any rate, he was one of those, as we know, he's just a very energetic, driven guy and always has been. And he still is to some extent, but he's also kind of just kind of turned his attention inward and kind of rearranged just how he looks at life. And it's really kind of refreshing. And I told him during our conversation, we spoke for about 40 minutes, and I said to him that literally one of the first things I see when I'm sitting on the side of the bed in the morning is one of his tweets. And it's usually mindfulness related, and it's usually well-intentioned and on point. And Pat's a very interesting guy and just a really refreshing guy on a lot of levels.
And now, Gordy, I'm gonna tell you, plug away. Tell us where the folks can read about Pat Croce.
Yes, this is on my blog. It's gordyjones.com. There's certainly no paywall or anything like that. So feel free to come and visit, because you know, I'm writing because I love to write, and I hope you would enjoy what I write. So that's why it's there. And I just really enjoyed a conversation that I had with Pat. So we move on from Pat to the Aaron Rodgers saga, and he finally appeared the other day on Kenny Mayne's Final Sports Center, and I'll read some of the things he said. He said, this is in regards to his situation with the Packers. Is he moving on? Is he not? And he said, I think sometimes people forget what really makes an organization. And, you know, history is important, legacy of so many people who've come before you, but the people, that's the most important thing. The people make an organization, people make a business, and sometimes that gets forgotten. And he goes on to say, later on, he had no problem with the Packers drafting his successor, Jordan Love, last year. And he said, I love the coaching staff, love my teammates, love the fan base in Green Bay, an incredible 16 years. It's just kind of about a philosophy, maybe forgetting that it is about the people that make the thing go. It's about character. It's about culture. It's about doing things the right way. And certainly that sounds to me that he's halfway out the door. Is that how you would interpret that, Mike?
I thought this was, I don't know. I still don't know what the hell he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I still, what is he talking about? I just don't, you don't like the GM, you know, suck it up and get on with it. I mean, I don't like some things about where I work. I don't understand this. And that interview, although it was noisy and much talked about, did not illuminate anything to me. I don't know. Certainly he wants to be out the door. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
I don't know if it could be fixed.
Doesn't sound like it.
I don't know. But I don't get it.
It's like, as I've told you before, I'm of two minds about this. I mean, I'd really like to see him come back to this team as a fan of the team, because I think the quarterback is the only position that there's really any uncertainty about, in my estimation. I think they have a really good team, and with him will be a Super Bowl contender. Without him, they'll just be a blah team. But on the other hand, I'm kind of resigned to whatever happens. You know, this day was going to arrive sooner or later, and I guess it's going to arrive sooner.
Yeah, but what you just said is, to some extent, an endorsement of the GM.
Yeah.
I mean, they have everything in place except the quarterback if he leaves.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying he's a good GM. I'm not saying that they have a great organization. I'm saying look at your football situation right now,
mm-hmm.
and look at the possible alternative football situations. How likely is it that you're going to get a better one? And how do you know you're going to love the GM where you're going?
Well, that is a fair point. That is a very fair point. I mean,
I
have no sense of what kind of GM Brian Gutekunst is, but it seems to me that he's addressed their needs, and or at least tried to address their needs every year. I mean, they've drafted pretty well. I thought they drafted well this year. They've brought in some good players, and they've made some nice free agent signings, and it seems like they've addressed their weaknesses. So I don't know. I mean, it's odd to me. It just seems like Rodgers is bound and determined that he's not going to be there. And the Packers, for their right, will, if he doesn't report, he did not report to the voluntary OTA this week. The mandatory one starts June 8th, and that's when the Packers can start fining him. So, they shouldn't really trade him till after June 1st because they take a bigger salary cap if they don't trade
and
him.
It won't happen. Yeah, it won't happen until June 1st for sure. I want to make one more point about this whole thing. When I wrote the column about this, and then that following week, I was talking to some people about the column and about this situation, and there's some people out there that are of the you know, well, these athletes, they're making millions of dollars, they should just shut up and play, it's not our job to consult with you and make you happy. And I don't have any problem with the player empowerment era. Generally speaking, if it's players versus owners, I'm on the side of the players.
Fair.
I'm not saying he doesn't have the right to do this. I'm just saying I don't understand why he's doing it. It doesn't make any sense to me.
No.
I'm questioning his judgment in doing it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair criticism for sure because, you know, as you said, where is he going to find a better situation than this? I mean, it's a really good team, and with him on it, it's a great team, you know?
Is it possible that he thinks, I mean, this is kind of a simplistic way to put it, but he thinks he's so good that he can make many football situations good ones?
Yeah, he's not wrong, but I mean, that one in particular, I think he puts over the top. I think he puts it right in the mix to win the Super Bowl.
Yeah, right. No, it's not just good; it's better than the one he's in.
Yeah, yeah. There's not many. I mean, Denver is the team you hear most often associated with the trade, and you know, I don't know.
No,
is that a better situation than Green Bay? I don't think
no.
so.
No.
So
the one that could be is the 49ers.
Yeah, I can't imagine they would trade him within their conference, especially not to the 49ers.
And they drafted a quarterback, they moved up in the draft to get a quarterback.
It's like the only way you trade him to the 49ers is if you get somebody like Bosa back, you know, or Bosa and another service, and then a couple
Bosa
picks.
Picks, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any way you trade him in the conference. I think that'd be the dumbest thing ever.
I mean, this will be interesting to watch because, I mean, it's an interesting and vexing situation to be in if you're the people running the Green Bay Packers. I'm afraid, as much as I enjoy Kenny Mayne's work, I don't think that interview shed any light on this situation,
well,
at least in a way that made it comprehensible to me.
Yeah, I think Rodgers is a pretty smart guy. I guess he just wasn't going to go there, you know?
he is a smart guy, which, again, makes us weirder.
Yeah. So we'll leave it there there'll certainly be more to talk about this topic.
We're not done with this story.
No,
sure.
this will linger for a few weeks longer at least, so.
Yep.
For the time being, I'm Gordy Jones, and he is Mike Gross, and we will talk to you soon.
See you later.